Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm wonderful, Sal. Yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. We've got some very important guests in this podcast room with us today.
What do you got for us?
Indiana State Senator Daryl Schmidt.
Wow, we're going to be on our best behavior.
That's right. But before we get started, as always, we got to start with the question of the day, Honorable Mr. Schmidt, Senator Schmidt. So you are not an exception.
Okay. Well, thank you for that very complimentary introduction. I'm Daryl, right?
Okay.
I'm Daryl the farmer, and Daryl just trying to help. But anyway, no, it's exciting. When you sent this about one of the toughest things that you had growing up, I couldn't come up with really one topic. So I kind of came up with my Senator Schmidt top five, kind of, you know, emulating David Letterman's top 10.
Your top five least favorite things on the farm when you were growing up.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
So number five would be chasing cattle and hogs through the tasseling cornfields.
Oh, my gosh.
Back in the day when we were young. Yeah. You know, they wasn't confined feeding operations like we have today, yep. Right? Everything was outside, and try to keep hogs in a woven wire fence,
you know,
even with electric fences around it. So I just remember they would get out, and there you're out running through the cornfields just trying to...
There's always one that will not come to that shaking bucket that you've got with some feed in it.
That's right. That's right. They go the other direction. But
the only thing that might be up there with that is chasing them through a recently logged woods with all the treetops and stuff.
That's interesting.
That's right. There you could even get poison ivy while you're going.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
So that was five.
Five, okay.
Now, number four, hoeing volunteer corn out of soybeans fields when it's about 100 degrees.
Yeah. I was central Indiana, so we cut Jimson weed, velvet leaf. So
it's Southern Indiana, same difference. Poke weed.
We'd have to get the poke berries, too, while we were getting the volunteer corn.
I had a dirt bike that I had a broken hoe, and I would just... I got to where I could just like do a El Cabong on them, drive by at about 15 miles an hour and just whack them as I was going through the soybean fields.
That's good. I wasn't allowed to take a motorcycle through it. That'd have been fun too. Number three, in Southern Indiana, there's a lot of turkey production, you know, so I grew up, on the farm. Mom and Dad started raising turkeys back in 1964, and back then everything was on range. You know, there weren't the big confined operations. It was more of a seasonal thing, but so the brooder houses where you had them were smaller back then. These were 1938 model ceramic tile buildings that you probably still see running around.
Yeah.
Well, back then, you didn't have skid steers and you had walk-in doors. So when you cleaned out the manure, that was all shoveled out with, you know. Now we use the scoop shovels for grain primarily and skid steers for the manure. But, you know, we had to scoop shovel everything out, the turkey manure out of those buildings.
Every year, twice a year?
Every flock.
Every flock.
Yeah, every time you ran a flock through, you know, you have them in a brooder house, it's typically 5 to 6 weeks old, and then you go to either. Now it's confined buildings, you know, where they're safer and they're safe from the coyotes and the owls. But back then, they would go out round range, and you'd clean out and get ready for another flock to come in.
Wow. Yeah, that would.
Out the man door and to the loader tractor.
Loader bucket, that's right. Or pull the little manure spreader right to the door, and you just shove through it right over the side of the manure spreader. But anyway, that's all good. Builds character, right? So number two was shoveling milo or a grain sorghum. You know, back in the day, you know, it was self-sustaining farming, right? You dabbled in, you know, a lot of different things, but there wasn't enough grain and acres. A lot of times you had you doubled up, or say you in the spring when you couldn't get corn planted early enough, kind of like maybe a year like this, and you needed feed early to feed the livestock. So you could plant, we'd plant some short season milo, 85 day milo in May, you know, the first part of May there, and you could start combining it, you know, in August yet, and use that to supplement the little corn you had left for feed. And I don't know if you've ever harvested milo.
Milo dust is the itchiest.
I've never been around it.
You do not want to be it.
That's right. It's my number two, so it's my second itchiest bit. So yeah, so you know exactly what that's about. So then my, you know, drum roll please.
Yes, all right.
Number one least favorite job would be baling twice rained on clover hay.
Oh.
That's the only thing itchier than milo.
Yeah, that makes me scratch just thinking about it.
Yeah, so you know, you'd harvest, you'd you know, mow the clover hay, and if you got it the first time, good. But if it dried out, rained on, then dried out and rained on again, those leaves would turn to dust and get down your neck. And
Nobody bales clover hay anymore.
No. Well, that was the old double crop, right?
Yeah.
What do we do now? You know, wheat and double crop beans. Well, back in the day, you'd had your hand seeder and you would frost seed the clover seed in February, you know.
Yep.
Go out there and do it by hand, frost seed the clover. And then after you combined the wheat and baled the straw, well, then the second crop was harvest that clover hay. Right.
We would spray it on with the 28 when frost seeded.
You did?
Yeah, it had John Blue pump. And if you put on enough gallons with flood jet nozzles, you could spray the clover on.
Oh, I didn't know
that. We did that.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. That was a lot better than
yeah.
With your hand seeder.
It just felt weird pouring that in the spray truck, though.
Yeah, I bet it did.
Yeah.
Oh, that's...
Well, Jeff, do you have a top five? I think I've got a top two now.
I was going to say, I could go along with a lot on that list, but I was going to say, you know, clean out bins, shovel manure. But also, I grew up, we had small farm, but we had a fertilizer plant. And we were all liquid suspension fertilizer. So I was the guy that was small enough to fit in all the tanks. So, I got shoved down there. I cleaned a lot of tanks out. So that had to be up on my list.
Like a fertilizer tank or a prowl tank?
Fertilizer tanks.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, those would be bad. 1034-0 sludge.
Yeah. Well, and then like I said, just suspension fertilizer. And, you know, you get a little grit and grime in the bottom. You had to clean, you know, shovel out. So
yeah, that's tough.
That's why I realized all of our employees seem to be big guys that didn't fit in the tanks near as good as a skinny little kid.
If you ever wanted to have a weight gain reason to put it on.
I think it's the only reason Dad kept me around.
Well, my dad's he's tough. He just turned 87. And, I mean, I've seen him in the old milk house. I've seen a rat run up one arm and down the other and him just grab it and squish it and throw it away. But he did not like hauling off dead animals. And on a farm, there's always something, right? Something's hogs or something's dead, and you don't always find it real quick, and you can't always get to it. That was my job. I was the dead animal, drag it to the loader tractor and haul it off. So that was my job on the, it didn't matter what it was, deer in the road or anything else. That was my job to haul it off.
Well, everybody that's eating breakfast, listening to the podcast this morning is, you know.
But that was my top one, so I'll just stick with that one.
That would be right up there.
Well, let's cutting tobacco. That was a bad one too. I don't know if you've ever done that.
Not in Central Indiana, we didn't.
Yes,
no, we didn't either.
Sticky and hot, and I mean, you had to just scrub the sticky tobacco off of you. So, but those are the two. Builds character, right?
Absolutely.
Well, Daryl, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be a Indiana state senator.
Well, it's kind of a long way to get there. I, grew up on a farm in Pike County and always loved ag and loved being outside and loved doing it. But I kind of wondered what if, right? What if I don't go out and see what's in the world, what if? So ended up going to school. Graduated from VU and then went to Indiana State, started working for UPS while I was at Indiana State. Graduated up there, went into full-time management with UPS. So I was off the farm. And back in 1992, Mom died of breast cancer when she had just turned 50. So, and I loved working at UPS, dealing with people. You know, we're a social species. So I was out dealing with people and doing that and came back. I'd met a gal about the time Mom died. Dad's farming by himself yet. And he's 50. We decided we were going to quit our jobs, change careers, move back home and start farming and raise a family. So we've been doing that for 31 years there since, or 32 actually. And, you know, as we were going, we just worked hard trying to pay off debt and raise a family and just focused on that, you know, wasn't involved in community and things. And then 2022, there was an opening on the Dubois County Council. I grew up in Pike, right on the line. Dad still lives in the same house that him and Mom bought in 1964 on the farm. I live a quarter mile away, but just so happened to be on the Dubois County side of the line. So there was an opening for a caucus on the Dubois County Council. The gentleman that was in our district took over as the treasurer. And I'm like, wow, you know, I wonder who's going to fill that spot. You know, that's important. Councils deal with the finances of the county. And my wife and I, we started talking and I was like, I wonder who's going to do that. And I told a friend, I said, you know, I said, he just retired from, he was an accountant at Kimball International. I said, you need to do that. You need to get on the council. He says, no. He said, you need to do that. I was like, oh, you're crazy. So I jumped back. I was on the track. Oh, I just kept working. And then all of a sudden I was like, thought about that over the weekend. I talked to Trish and I was like, you know, I think it's time to put up or shut up. What do you think? And we talked about it and, you know, decided the timing was right and just decided I could give back at the local level. And I got involved and I found that servant's heart. You know, you want to help people and get involved. So I did that. And then you never know where the good Lord takes you a couple of years down the road. Then, you know, last year, our 8th District Congressman decided to not run for re-election. So our state senator in District 48 ran for that. He's now our congressman. So that opened up, you know, this state senate seat. So I was like, well.
And this was what year?
This is last year. This is last year. This all happened, you know, here in 2024. So I'm like, you know, I want to continue to advocate for, you know, rural Southern Indiana, the rural community and the local area. How can I be an advocate? Can I be a better advocate staying on the county council and locally, or could I possibly go to Indianapolis, become a state senator and try to advocate for all of, you know, rural Indiana? And ultimately that's the path that I chose, that I sought after. And I was fortunate enough to get elected. So, you know, here I am. You never know where the good Lord takes you.
That's awesome.
That's important for us as in ag, in our ag industry, whether we're farmers or ag retailers or equipment dealers, to have somebody in the state government that understands farming, you know, and that can be from different levels, but it's got to be pretty unique to be a farmer up in the in Indianapolis, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, as ag, we're typically a humble profession. You know, we don't brag on ourselves. We don't advocate for ourselves enough. We don't tell our story well enough. So now when I go up there, I feel it's my responsibility, you know, to represent, you know, all of rural Indiana and represent ag, just to create that understanding. You know, people just, you know, as generations have moved, you're away. You don't understand. So, yeah, so that's a goal of mine, to try to help people. There are a lot of good people in the Senate. You know, Senator Cook that represents, you know, here Jackson County and Seymour, great guy, you know, but he doesn't have an ag background. So there's a lot of great people up there, but they don't have that background, have that understanding. So that's what I want to do, is just to try to help and increase that. There's, you know, myself, I guess I should say Kendall Culp is a House from the House of Representatives side. I think he was elected in 2022. So he had the title of the only farmer, full-time farmer, driving their income in the General Assembly. Well, we doubled our population. So doubled. Now I'm the only farmer in the Senate side. Now there are other people that, you know, that are once removed, you know, they're landowners yet once removed from farming. Senator Lysing here, she was to the east. She used to farm. She's retired now, but she's the chair of the Ag Committee. On the Senate side, she's well versed, you know, does a great job, you know, in it. But that's, you know, that's we're trying to, you know, we want to work and increase that now. So that's, yeah, that's a goal of mine, is I feel that responsibility, not just for District 48 that I represent, or 6 counties in southwestern Indiana, but just all of rural Indiana. Yeah.
What was the biggest? I mean, that's got to be a little bit of a culture shock coming from, you know, running the family farm business, and now all of a sudden you're in the Senate for the state of Indiana. What was the culture shock like? What was some of the biggest learnings that you had to overcome, you know, when you go to Indianapolis?
Well, I had, you know, you always want to try to do your research and your homework. So even when I was on the county council, I would go up and watch from the balcony while they were in session, you know, like, you know, so I had an idea, but it is a big difference, you know, in ag or in private industry. If you see a problem that you need to solve, you know, you come up, you see the problem, you identify it, you figure out how you're going to solve it, and you go solve it. Yeah. So you get from point A to, you know, you get from 1 to 10 real fast.
Especially if you got a track hoe and you can.
Well, yeah. Right. That's right. Well, yeah. You know, you're going to attack the problem, right, and you're going to solve it. Politics, you know, government is a little more complicated. It takes and I guess that's by design, right? You know, you can look at the federal level, the executive branch. Right now, we kind of yo-yo back and forth on policies and priorities. So the legislature, it's designed so it has to be delivered so you don't overreact. But that's the frustrating part. It takes a little bit to, you know, you might not go from 1 to 10 one year. And if you're trying, you know, if you're moving the bar in the right direction, you might go from 1 to 3. It just takes a little longer to solve the problem. It's a lot more complicated, but you're trying to get everybody involved. So that was, I guess it's a slower process.
What's it been like, you know, because we don't have a lot of, you know, farmers in, you know, in the House or the Senate. So when you have a bill that's directly related to farming, it's like the grain bill that just passed and yes. stuff. I mean, when you're trying to work through that process to get from 1 to 10, is everybody pretty open to learning? Are they asking you a lot of questions? Or are they coming to you as like, hey, you're the farmer. Like, tell us what this means. I mean,
absolutely.
Good.
They will, you know, as you learn people, you know who people's responsibilities, what their strong points are, because there were 1,300 and some bills that were proposed this session, you know, and I don't exactly have the numbers, but I think it was 200 and some that actually made it through and got passed. But you can't intimately know and do the research on that. So you have to work together and find the experts in the field and seek out that knowledge. So yeah, that was a responsibility of mine. You know, people would ask me, or I would seek them out, you know, and try to make sure they get the accurate information, because no matter what your topic is or your issue, there are people advocating on both sides of it, right? So you have to make sure you can get the true story out there and get the information to them.
What about committee work? Are you working on any of the different committees? I know they have different committees for different things.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on the education, I'm on elections, family and children services, local government, insurance and financial institutions. So I'm on all the easy ones.
Wow.
But it's a handful, but it's good. So I'm on those. And then actually, I just found out 2 days ago, I'm on the interim study committee for ag and natural resources for the summer. So there'll be, you know, topics that we'll be working on this summer and studying, looking a lot at like the, you know, economic value of like all our public lands, you know, our, you know, state forests and things, and you know, trying to get a better analysis of that. So then there'll be other topics. But so I am on the interim study committee. So yes.
So you got plenty to do.
Absolutely. No, it's great though. It's all good.
Well, they say Indiana's got a part-time state assembly, but it's not just, so you're in session, actually in session from what time to when, but it's not really part-time. It's all year round, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like part-time, full-time.
Yeah, right.
Part-time pay, full-time work. That's okay. That's not why you get into this. This year, we started session on January the 8th, and we finished on, I believe it was April 25th. So basically, I leave, I go up on Sunday nights, and then I come home on Thursday nights. So yeah, we're up there 4 days a week, working all the way through the session. Now, in Indiana, we have a biennial budget. This was the budget year, so it's a long session. So we were there basically, you know, till the middle to the end of April this year. Now, next year, you know, coming up here in 2026, there will not be budget items. It'll be, you know, other things. So it'll be what they call a short session. So there we'll be up there basically January through the middle of March.
Oh.
So that's when we're up there. I have physically only been back to the state house 3 times since session was over in April. One was for a bill signing yesterday on education. Actually 2 days ago, sorry. But there's a lot of work done locally now. Now, when we finished up the budget, now you have to go out, and now that's being implemented on the local level. So I am working. My goal and a commitment was to get to every taxing unit in the district in those 6 counties. So I'm out every night going to different city council and county council meetings and town council meetings, try and help them explain to them and understand what's going on. You know, that was Tuesday. I started out at Pike County at their county council meeting. Then I went to a bill signing at Indianapolis. And then by the afternoon I was at the Huntingburg council meeting that evening. And then I had a 7:30 meeting in Spencer County, just trying to get around and help. So that's the difference. Now you're out meeting with constituents and trying to learn what's going on. You know, how do you understand, and how can you make good decisions if you're not out there getting involved and meeting with people and understanding what the priorities are?
That's good.
There's 140,000 people in the 6 counties that I represent. It's Gibson, Pike, Dubois, Spencer, Perry, and Crawford counties, those 6 counties. So 50 senators in Indiana, and each senator represents roughly 140,000 people.
So do you have a lot of those constituents? Are they reaching out to you on a daily basis and bringing you things, or, you know, how do you manage all that? And do you have a staff?
What we have is we have what we call legislative assistants. So it's a full-time gentleman. Braden's his name, at Indianapolis. Okay. He's graduated college. He's working on getting into law school. So myself and Senator Baldwin on the north side of Indy, we share him. So he works for both of us, and he'll help do a lot of the research and things. So that basically, if I have questions I don't know, you know, he'll find out and he'll work with, and he'll act as an intermediary. If a constituent has a problem with NDOT or, you know, IDEM or whatever state agency, and whatever the question may be, I'll help him. And if I can't, he'll help and work and do some research and help facilitate. So yeah, I can't tell you the number of phone calls and text, and when I turn my phone back on a little bit, there'll be another 10 emails and 15 texts, but it's good, you know. But yes, people will reach out, and you just try to, that's what's going on now, solving a lot of the problems and trying to get answers. You know, people don't know where to turn. It's kind of complicated.
And sure.
There's a lot of good people in state government that are up there working in these bureaucracies, but we've got some work to do on increasing our customer service, right? As constituents and as people, we're the customers, right? We're the customers that the federal or the state government is to support, and you know, they're working for us. So we've got a little work to do on customer service on some things, but you know, a lot of great people in there. So we try to facilitate when people have questions, try to help them navigate that.
What I think the grain bill was probably the biggest thing we talked about all spring. But as you look forward, what's on the horizon for, you know, specific things affecting ag? Do you have a couple that you see coming that you want to work on?
We can talk about the property taxes, how they affected farmers. If you want to,
sure.
That was one that Senate Bill 1, Senate Rolled Act 1 now. There's a philosophical move. They started, and we talked about, you know, sessions. Well, when the long session in April of 2023 was over, they started a number of interim study committees. They started looking at our property tax system. We have one of the most complicated property tax systems in the country. Indiana does.
Took like 60 or 70 or 80 years to get there, probably. But
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But so it's complicated. The goal is, it's like a 7-year transition here to increase transparency, increase the simplicity of our property tax system, and drive decisions to the local level as much as possible. Anytime that decisions leave the federal government and go to the state government and leave state government and go to the federal government, at the local level, I think we can make better decisions because we're intimately involved in it, you know?
Yeah.
Just like we're a part-time legislature, you're also... local government's the same way. You see everybody at church on Sunday, right? And if they don't like something, they'll wait till you get outside the church doors and then they're going to tell you about it, right?
Yeah.
But it's good. So there was a bunch of changes, but it's basically a 7-year plan to transition to a more simple model. Okay. So there's going to be a few bumps in the road, like in, think of your home as valued at $150,000. Okay. You know, so that's the 1% of your homesteads or the 1% cap. If your home's valued at $150,000, by the time we get to year 7, it's going to be gradually get there. By the time we get to year 7 in 2031, we will get, as homeowners, a 2/3 deduction of our assessed value, and we'll pay property taxes on 1/3 of the assessed value of the home. Okay. The 2%ers caps, which will be our land, right, and rental properties, apartments, they will end up getting a deduction. Say if it's a $150,000 piece of property, get a deduction of $50,000 off their assessed value. They'll pay 2/3 of the assessed value of property taxes. The 3%ers, the corporations, will end up paying property taxes on a full amount of the assessed value. So deductions will kind of go away on certain deductions, but it'll be more simplified. Instead of so many different things, it'll be more of a simplified process. And then kind of, you know, so that plays into it, something for ag. But if you also look, and I didn't really realize this till I got involved, but ag land, you know, all different or different categories in property taxes. Well, you figure out property taxes for your ag land. You're trying to figure out why they go up so much and why they've been really skyrocketing. It's a combination of market value of the land, but it's also a 6-year rolling average of marketing of commodities, you know, prices, grain prices. Okay. Well, now we took a nosedive, you know, on our grain prices. But if you look at that 6-year rolling average, there's a lot of high grain prices, you know, still in that 6-year rolling average. So what the legislature did, when you took all those numbers and then you divided it by a capitalization rate, and our capitalization rate's been 8%. Okay, now for the next 2 years, the capitalization rate will be 9%. So you take that bigger number dividing, that's lowering the assessed. That will lower the assessed value on the land for 2 years until the commodity prices that we're seeing now are figured into that formula. Okay, so that's one of the things that'll help us as farmers and the ag community. Now, the other thing will be business personal property taxes. You know, right now it's everything under $80,000. If you have $80,000 or less of business personal property tax, you don't pay business personal property tax. In 2027, it will go to $2 million.
Wow.
Okay, so what that does is that's going to help small businesses. You know, you will not pay business personal property taxes, you know, on that moving forward if you're less than $2 million. Now, if you're above $2 million, it starts back at $1. You know, and I guess the only caveat is if you're in a TIF district, until that the property tax revenues is being used to back the bond. So if you're in the middle of a bond payment, until that bond settled, it won't. It's a TIF. So there's a few exceptions to the rule, but for the most part, that will go to $2 million. And then also, so that's to incentivize small businesses and, you know, small farms and, you know, taking that burden off, because ultimately when we get going and it's year seven, the corporations pay for 100% of the property tax or 100% of the assessed value. One other thing is a lot of older equipment, you know, once it's depreciated out, you go back to that 30, you always have that 30% floor, right? That will, for purchases from January 1st of this year moving forward, that 30% floor will not be there anymore. Okay, so when it's depreciated out, your personal property taxes will be done. You will not be paying personal property taxes on that. What we have now will stay there until you're selling that equipment or trading it up, as long as you have. But for moving forward, so that'll be significant. Yeah. That'll be significant for the ag community, a benefit that was is the business personal property tax, that 30% floor going away for moving forward.
And I'm assuming there's a whole bunch of people that are trying to, you know, figure out this complicated, you know, structure. And as we make it simpler, they're also studying the fact to make sure that we don't create deficits. And absolutely. We don't get to the end of the year and go, well, we don't have enough money to pay the bills.
That's right. Well, and that's why they use that $2 million threshold, you know, so that your big, you know, power plants and big factories of that part, you know, they're above the $2 million, so they won't be exempt for that, because yeah, we couldn't make, you had to worry about local government revenue. We're not trying to see property taxes are collected at the local level, used at the local level. The state government has no bearing in that. Okay. The property taxes are all used for local governments, whether it's, you know, schools, you know, airports, fire departments, the whole thing. You know, so and roughly two-thirds of in rural America, rural Indiana, roughly two-thirds of the property tax are collected are going to schools. You know, so we had to watch so we didn't affect that too much. Now, since two-thirds of the property tax roughly go to schools, they were, you know, when everybody was clamoring for property tax relief, more of that the schools were being affected a little bit more. So now, what most people don't realize, and I didn't until I got up there, the property tax collected, that's for facilities, capital projects on schools. Okay. There's also what they call state tuition support. And that's the amount of money that the state provides to schools. And that funds teacher salaries, you know, staff, and then things of that nature. So part of this, when there was a $2 billion shortfall and you heard about, you know, all the cuts that are coming at the state level, well, K-12 education was spared and kept out of that because we didn't want to affect our kids, right? And the you know, that's important, you know, building for the future. So some of the schools, you know, took a little bit. Some will have a smaller revenue than last year. Some won't. Some are increasing revenue, but not near as a rate of increase. So $980 million increase for the state tuition support for K through 12 over the next 2-year budget. Wow. So that was a way to kind of offset this, you know, this transition period. So we don't have any negative effects. And there's no intention of making a total shift. You know, we're not trying to shift where the taxes are being collected. You know, not trying to shift all from property to income. There will be local governments will be able to use LIT taxes, local income taxes, to kind of fill up fill the gaps a little bit on the changes. That's all part of the 7-year plan to increase decision-making control at the local level. So I apologize. I got maybe a little more into the property tax, coming out of ag and the background and finances, and we have to know numbers, and I like the numbers and getting in on there. There's a lot of good things going on, and everybody needs to know that. But that basically for us, you know, as farmers in the ag community, the change in the capitalization rate will cushion that, you know, make that formula make more sense. And then the business personal property will be a long-term, you know, benefit.
Sure.
What about the big, beautiful bill that just got passed in D.C.? is there anything coming from that bill that will impact us as a state that we need to make changes, you know,
yes,
with our assembly?
I have not. Well, it's going to affect us some, but I don't know the details on exactly how it's going to affect us as a General Assembly. I know, like, I just saw headlines about, you know, some modifications in elections, maybe. I mean, I'm sorry, education, a reduction, a little bit of money for the education, but nothing I think that we can't handle. I don't think there's going to be any major impacts that are going to hurt us. You know, I've got there some of the changes, you know, that they were, let's see here. I brought some notes on it restores 100% immediate expensing for farm equipment capital investments. Basically, I guess they're making the 179s, you know, where that's going to stay. Full and permanent repeal of the federal estate tax. You know, so there's a lot of different things and a lot of things that they made permanent, like the 1031 tax exchanges and stuff. You know, they're preserving that. Cash accounting. They were talking about getting rid of cash accounting methods, you know, for farmers, which that would be a real problem. So there's some of those coming at the federal level yet, but, you know, they're still sorting out that however many thousand page bill. Yeah. Yes. But I haven't seen anything yet that's a big red flag for us at the state level and how we're going to be able to overcome that.
It is. Generating revenue, was it ever discussed to go to a sales tax and to get either eliminate or partially move to a state sales tax versus a income or property tax?
Yeah, there's that discussion is ongoing all the time on how to do that. And I guess property taxes, you know, the goal is to reduce, you know, is reduce property taxes. Obviously there was a bunch of, a bunch of clamoring for that because it had been going up significantly. There's a balance that has to be made, right? You have to also generate property taxes are pretty reliable and stable. It's a stable where your income taxes are a little bit different. You know, you have other states that, that utilize sales taxes more. So I guess, there's a lot of everything's on the table, but I don't know that it will ever totally get away from property taxes. When we ended up with the $2 billion shortfall that you guys probably heard about, you know, came out in April. And what that $2 billion was from January, February, March of 2024 to January, February, March of 2025, it was a projection of the state was going to be down $2.3 billion in revenue. Okay. Of that, there was a big drop in income tax revenue collected. You know, you'll look at the sales tax and individual corporate income tax, all those levels, but the income taxes is what it actually, that were down 25.9%, I believe is what it was. So that was the big, big fluctuation. So those are some of the pitfalls, you know, and dangers. Yeah.
Moving to something that could be more variable.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, Tennessee, you know, they have their sales taxes a ton higher, but, they're more of a, I guess the tourism industry, right? Sure. You know, you look at Florida, you look at Tennessee, you're drawing people in, you know, for tourism. So, you know, a lot of that's based off of that too, where we're a little bit more manufacturing based and not, well, I mean, we're working on tourism. We got a lot of great things in Indiana to look at, but those are all factors and those are all decisions or I guess items that we used, you have to look at to make those decisions. So, you know,
that's interesting.
Yeah. And then this is drawing a lot when I'm giving the statement, some of it's from Senator Daryl Schmidt, but I've been a senator for 10 months. So a lot of it's from Daryl Schmidt, the farmer and Daryl Schmidt that, you know,
and that's good. That's okay.
The old guy. So, yeah. So, you know what I mean? So those are, there's a lot of things that you have to look at.
That's so what, future aspirations? Do you think you want to take this from the state level to the federal level?
Governor?
You want to make an announcement here today on the high ground?
No announcement today on that. I will officially announce that I'm going to be running for Senate again. I'll file for that down the road here, but there'll be an official announcement coming later this summer that I'm going to run again in 2026 for re-election to the Senate. So,
see, we heard it here first.
That's right.
You did. So, but further than that, when I came in, when I decided to do this, just like we talked earlier, I had no axe to grind, no preconceived notions. I didn't decide to go to Indianapolis because I had a hot topic that I wanted, that I was really mad about, that I wanted to do. I just wanted to, you know, get involved and help and give back. And, you know, like I said, we work so hard to raise a family and try to pay down debt. And now it's an opportunity. And, you know, my wife's sacrificing a ton because I'm on the road, gone all the time. But we looked at it that, you know, it was worth the sacrifice to give back, you know, to help the next generation. So that's why I'm doing it. No axe to grind, no preconceived notions, just kind of going with the flow and helping and anything I can to just continue to tell our story in ag and improve the state. Yeah,
very good.
Well, one other thing that I want to hit on, I almost forgot this one, is what is going on in the legislature for land use in the state of Indiana? I know we've got some water issues up in Boone County with some of the businesses that are coming in there require a lot of water. I know that was a hot topic there for a while. You know, but when we look at land use and, you know, whether it's solar panels or, you know, just urban sprawl, you know, is what are we doing to look to protect farmland? Can you speak about that?
Yeah, there are studies going on, and I can't remember what exactly bill it was, but there's going to be an analysis of amount of acres that come out of ag land. It's going to be a recurring analysis. I think it's every 5 years that we will continue to monitor and watch. And I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it was an amazing amount. It was like almost 400,000 acres of land that came out of ag production since 2012.
Oh my gosh.
I think it's 300 and some thousand acres in the state. So that is a priority to look and to watch and to take care of that. Your water, as far as Boone County and all that up there, there was talk of, you know, moving a bunch of water from, piping a bunch of water from, you know, Tippecanoe.
Tippecanoe, yeah.
Exactly. There was legislation, and I think I actually have that exact bill here, but basically what the legislation said was that now you cannot just randomly take water from one watershed to the other. There's a threshold of, it's so many million gallons, but, you know, it's a pretty low bar that you have to be able to, I guess it's a high bar, a low amount of gallons. You're going to have to work through Department of Natural Resources. They're going to be involved, and anytime you try to transfer water from one watershed to the other, there's a process that you have to go through, the utilities to go through, to make sure that we don't have any unintended consequences. So this was the first time that the Indiana legislature got involved in water regulation. And we need to do that. I mean, a lot of other states, you know, there are lawyers and law firms that just specialize in water law. You know, you go out west where there's a lot more issues. So this was our first foray as a state legislature. We're getting into that. So there are a bunch of protections, you know, that are being put in to take care of that.
Well, in the Eastern Corn Belt, I mean, we have so much water. It's not like Kansas or Nebraska, you know, in the eastern Nebraska or western Nebraska, where, you know, they regulate it to so many inches per year. We have so much here, but it's good to good to get the water regulations figured out before you have to, I guess.
We need to be ahead of the curve. We don't want to be reactive, you know. And you were kind of alluding to, I guess, energy also fits into this. Data centers, you know, they project the state of Indiana, we're going to need to double our energy output in the next 10 years.
Wow.
You know, as all the young ones have to have AI and we increase the amount of, you know, usage on the internet. Well, those are also, you know, data centers are energy intensive and water intensive, you know, so that's the reason we have to be on top of it for the water. Looking at other, possible energy sources. I mean, you're starting to hear a lot about small modular reactors, you know, smaller nuclear reactors that are going to using more of that as a base load. There was a push through the legislature to make sure that we don't end up, retiring plants before we have replacements. There's times where my understanding that we're pretty close, you know, to max capacity, you know, running through the grid when it's hot, that, you know, where we don't want to end up having blackouts and rolling blackouts and things. But
you've got a lot of power plants in your district too.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's why I'm interested. That's one of the committees I'd like to get on is utilities. But there's a lot of things down the road, and these data centers, you know, as you move forward, you know, as the SMRs might become a player in that, if you end up with they're smaller. It's not like the Marble Hills and things that you had in years past, or Three Mile Islands. It's a smaller type setup. You know, they've been using nuclear reactors on submarines,
aircraft
and things
carriers,
forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's more along the line of those concepts. So there's a lot of things coming down the road that, you know, that are being looked at.
Neat. That's pretty neat. I've learned a lot this morning.
I have too. That's why we have these guests, because Sal and I, we don't know a lot, so we need to learn from you guys.
Well,
so.
I don't know a lot either. I'm just trying to do my best and try to help and learn. We all learn as we go.
Well, is there any other topics?
I think we need to make this a regular, scheduled check-in. You need to come back and visit with us, especially as you get up here and you learn about things. We'd love to have you come back and say, hey, I need to update you guys. So,
I'd love to do that. And actually, we probably went through 10% of the notes and things that we had. So there's a lot of topics and a lot of things we can delve deeper into. I tried to hit the highlights. One thing I would maybe add, you know, as farmers, we have to be cognizant now, you know, in the summertime, especially this time of year at our rural intersections, you know, there's
the corn is up,
the corn is tall. So we have to watch to make sure people can see what they're doing. I want to be an advocate. You know, there was different legislation that came in and out that we were, you know, that we were looking at ways to improve safety, but I guess it's a lot easier, I guess I would say, as farmers to be proactive and to do our best to try to, you know, keep that line of sight vision at intersections, you know, that we don't want, you know, those are local issues that we need to keep local, and we need to have our, you know, if we can police ourselves and do a good job of being good stewards and good neighbors for everybody, that's something we want to do. Just an awareness tool this time of year, you know, because we all get busy in our things and we're like, oh man, you know, we accidentally swung the planter too wide. So that would be one thing I'd maybe want to say. We all want to be conscious. And
I think people, there's intersections they go through where they can do their rolling stops 6 months out of the year and they can see everything coming. But right now you can't, you
and
can't
that corn's
see that.
Up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be one thing I want to encourage. We all work together.
Good. Absolutely.
That's a good topic or a good thought to end on right there, is just the safety and being and watching when we're out there on these roads. Because it can happen fast. Come up on the crossroads and you can't see good.
That
sure can.
All right. So. Well, Daryl, thank you for joining us this morning. And that'll be another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.